This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When history gets written into a school textbook, it takes on an aura of authority. It becomes the semi-official, approved version of events, the national narrative a country wants its children to learn. In that context, it's hardly surprising that the lessons of the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example, are taught differently in Havana than in Hartford. In many cases, though, foreign texts cover material that American kids never even see. Nigeria's role in the slave trade, for example, or Canada's long-standing fears of American invasion. With the high school text being perhaps the only history book that most people read in many countries, what they learn in school can profoundly influence how they come to regard Americans and American policies. Later in the program, official errors cost a South Korean gymnast first place in Athens, but he may get his gold yet. But first, what we can learn about U.S. history from the textbooks of other countries. If you went to school in another country, how were your history lessons different? And if you teach history, what do you hear from your students who are from other countries? Our number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And the co-authors of History Lessons, How Textbooks from Around the World Portray U.S. History, join us now. Dana Lindemann is a professor of French at Harvard University, and he joins us from our bureau in Chicago. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Kyle Ward is a professor of history at Vincennes University. He's with us from his office in Vincennes, Indiana. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil.
And let's start with the idea for the book. How did this come about?
I'll start off with that one. Back in 1999-2000, Dana and I were both working as high school teachers at a private college preparatory school back in Minnesota. And I was a history teacher there. I taught U.S. history and world history. And the uniqueness of this school was the fact that we had students that represented some 40 to 45 different nations from around the world. So I would go in teaching one of my U.S. history courses and talk about the War of 1812 or World War II or anything else where the U.S. had foreign relations with other countries, and it never failed, but a student's hand would go up and make some comment about, well, when I lived in Canada, Japan, Egypt, whatever country it is, that's not how we learned it. That wasn't the way it was taught to us, or you're not telling us everything that came through with it. So after a while of having this happen to me, I turned to Dana, who had a background in French and French culture and had done some research on French textbooks. And we talked to him about this, too, and said, wouldn't that be an interesting book? We should look and find out where that's at. So we started doing some research and discovered that no one had written that book yet.
So, Dana Lindemann, you guys decided to come up with the first comparative study of high school textbooks?
That's right. Based on some of these things that the students were choosing or had raised issues about, we picked some of those things, selected some topics that where the U.S., their history came in contact with somebody else's history, and just decided to try to take a look at what was the other side, what's the other perspective on that.
And there are some fascinating examples. I mentioned just a few of them, but I'm just leafing through. Sorry, I made some notes here, and I'm trying to find them. For example, the War of 1812, you both just mentioned that, and obviously it gets viewed differently in Canada than it does in the United States. Interestingly, for example, in British textbooks, they largely accept the argument that the War of 1812 was a dispute between Great Britain and the United States over the impressment of sailors on the high seas. Kyle Ward seen very differently in Canada.
Both these countries have taken a different viewpoint of this whole thing. For the Canadians, and it's kind of a constant theme in their textbooks, the War of 1812 turns out to be a United States invasion of their country, which seems to be a constant fear for them. Later on, you read in their textbooks that they claim that in 1867, they had to form as a nation because after the American Civil War was over, there was a fear that the U.S., and I quote their textbook says, that we were going to invade the United States for the third time.
Canada.
Yes, into Canada. And Dan and I always go back, the first time we read that, we both said, you know, the third time. We didn't know there were three different times.
The other was in the American Revolution.
Exactly right. They count that, and they also count the War of 1812. And so they were bracing themselves for what they figured was American imperialism, and they were going to come after them. So the provinces had to join together.
And Dana Lindemann, it's interesting how much of a factor this, girding up against a potential outside invader, at least according to the Canadian textbooks, how much of a factor that plays in Canadian nationalism.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, there's one point during this War of 1812, or even the Revolutionary War, where they talk about the heroic resistance of those in the Northern Canadian or the Northern British North American territories, and how part of their identity came about, was formed as around this sort of anti-American feeling. And so they actually talk about this anti-American sentiment as being a core ingredient in that portion at that time of Canadian nationality.
It's also important to recognize that there are distinctions between history textbooks, the way they're produced and distributed and sold here in the United States, and how they are in many other countries in the world. I mentioned semi-official versions of history in the introduction. In some places, it's the official version of history. Kyle?
Yeah, you definitely find when you start looking at these different countries, you kind of end up with one extreme with the United States, where we have a handful of textbook publishers who are producing any number of textbooks that high school history teachers can choose from, to more of an extreme, North Korea and Cuba and Vietnam come to mind right off the top of my head, where the government has said, this is the one and only textbook, and this is the curriculum that goes along with it. There is no variation in that.
And even in reading some of the excerpts from the Mexican history books, they constantly referred to our country and our people.
Yeah, there's definitely this sense of this our and this we. And in fact, some of the countries that Kyle mentioned, there's some of the non-democratic societies, you get the sense that there's this everyman heroic figure in the history. And so in North Korea, for example, they talk about at one point where this heroic figure had to, he was dying, he's been shot, and the cables have been severed on some communication line, and he uses his own blood vessels to patch this cable up so that the defense can go on of the heroic homeland.
That's good surgery.
Very good surgery. The other example is Cuba, where one of the dying patriots writes in his own blood as he's dying on the wall, Fidel, which is testament to the fidelity that they feel toward Castro. But it's the state that's producing the textbooks.
It's also important to realize that you're going through this not to find howlers like the North Korean hero, but rather to point out differences between what other countries write in their textbooks and what we do, and try to figure out why.
Yeah, exactly. We have kind of gone through, and we've kind of discovered when we did the research here, is that there are kind of three different categories that you can find. One is the things that these countries just absolutely positively disagree with us. North Korea and Cuba come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
There are some countries that there are varying shades of gray. England and Germany come to mind, where there's a little bit of disagreement. You can find the classic example for England is during the American Revolutionary War. Their one shot is that Thomas Paine, who we put up on a pedestal as being the author of Common Sense and a forebearer of the revolution, they like to point out that he sold women's undergarments before he came to the United States. And the third thing is those things that we just couldn't find in the textbooks in the U.S. whatsoever. Cuba is the best example of that, where they talk in their Cold War era about the United States for the last 50 years using biological warfare against them.
Explaining bad crops in the past, that sort of thing.
Yeah, any bad crops, animal diseases on the homeland are all caused by the CIA and the U.S.
In other countries, as you say, the differences are fascinating. The origins of the slave trade, for example, interesting to read in the Portuguese textbook. Portugal, of course, was the first country that started the transatlantic slave trade. The Africans did it already, so it wasn't that big a deal.
Exactly. It's one of the first lines that they have is, like they had it going on already. The other thing about the section on slavery is the Nigerian text, where they talk that Nigerians are quite interestingly frank about, hey, listen, we did some of this stuff to ourselves. In fact, we were some of the proponents of the slave trade. We turned against each other. And they look actually at one point at the benefits of the slave trade, which you would never see in an American textbook. But they look at, so what happened? We got rid of some of the undesirables, some of the stubborn children, this, that, the next thing. But in the end, they come back to, but it cost us a lot. You got rid of some of the able-bodied people, skilled workers, this sort of thing. And then what is the end? The net result is still bad, but they take a look at why did we do it to ourselves, which is very interesting.
That's Dana Lindemann. We're also speaking with Kyle Ward. They are co-authors of History Lessons, How Textbooks from Around the World Portray U.S. History. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, or send us an email, totn@npr.org. Let's talk to George, and he's on the line with us from San Antonio, Texas.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, I'm an author and a historian, and I've written a, an archaeologist, and I've written a book about the Alamo, and I've had to do book signings. Are you there?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we're here.
And I've done many book signings at the Alamo, and it's very interesting because we have a lot of international people from not only around the world, but especially Mexico. And Mexican history books dwell quite differently on the Texas Revolution and the Mexican War than we do. And our textbooks, I noticed, don't mention much about the Mexican War, in which we took the northern half of Mexico by invasion and, you know, force of arms. And we sort of gloss over that, whereas they're still pretty much smarting over the loss of half of their territory. And they've actually done a strange thing. They blame, apparently, General Santa Anna, just as we blame Santa Anna. And so it seems that both countries have sort of developed a scapegoat. And, you know, they don't really face the actual sort of ugly parts of it. But
Here's the relevant excerpt from a Mexican textbook, The Mexican Resistance and Defense of the Capital in the War Against the USA. And this is, of course, the Mexican people assumed an attitude of bravery and great heroism. On the other hand, President Santa Anna, the high military command, and the ecclesiastical hierarchy gave in while surrendering to the invaders or helping the foreigners. For its part, the troops, made up roughly of half the army and workers principally from the capital, rose up to fight and resist with great heart and courage against the U.S. invasion. And, of course, they emphasize the boy heroes of Chapultepec and the battalion of St. Patrick and that sort of thing. So stories, Kyle Ward, we're not going to see in American textbooks.
And the other thing that really jumps out about this one here that I found really interesting is the fact, and I don't know what this says about history and our cultures and anything else like that, but the fact that in American history textbooks, we spend some time talking about the Alamo. And the movies have come out. We kind of spend a lot of time dealing with that one topic, a battle that was lost by the Americans and the Texans who were fighting there. Whereas if you look at the Mexican textbook, it doesn't show up. It's not a great victory. They don't even spend any time dealing with it.
But Chapultepec, which is portrayed as, I guess, their Alamo in a way, the boy heroes don't get a lot of coverage in American textbooks.
No, none at all, really. And it's really, it spreads again to this sort of populist theme that they have where you too as a child or you too can participate in the history of your own country and in the identity building. You can participate in that identity.
Hmm. Were you surprised to see that, I guess, of course, by the way, George, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
The history book says, well, of course, the Mexican people fought valiantly against the invaders, but Santa Anna, the political leadership and the ecclesiastical leadership all betrayed them.
This is kind of a common theme that you see running throughout a lot of them. Dana is building on what he said earlier, too. There is this the everyman history kind of intertwined into a lot of these different national narratives, in which they do tell the story about the one individual. And some point in time, the government did fall apart, or the government wasn't there to back them up. And it was up to the people of this country to get them through the battle or whatever problems they may have had.
Mm-hmm. Part of it, too, is if you look at France is another example. During there's a section in here on the resistance during World War II where your history has to be this long narrative building up towards something. It has to be your identity as a people. And if your identity culminates in something like the Vichy regime in France, for example, then what is your identity served? But somehow you have to skirt that. And so the Mexican example, you have the populist uprising. The people know the true identity of the Mexicans and is to resist the invader. And they call the American army invaders at that point in their text. And for the French, it's Vichy was not really France. The French government was with de Gaulle in England, and it was with the resistance that fought valiantly against the Nazi occupation.
And real Frenchmen were, of course, all in the Maquis.
Exactly.
That's right. Well, maybe they haven't seen the sorrow and the pity. Anyway, we're going to take more of your calls when we come back from a short break. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests, Dana Lindemann and Kyle Ward, we're talking about their new book, History Lessons, How Textbooks from Around the World Portray U.S. History. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about what we can learn by looking at how other countries portray U.S. history in their textbooks. Our guests are Dana Lindemann and Kyle Ward, co-authors of the book history lessons, how textbooks from around the world portray U.S. history. Did you learn a different version of history than the one they teach in American classrooms? If so, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. And let's get another caller on the line. Earl is with us from Pensacola, Florida.
Hello, sir. How are you doing today?
I'm good.
I just wanted to call in because this topic is very near and dear to my heart. My mother was an avid studier of this kind of subject. We did a lot of traveling when I was younger, and she would always ask people from foreign countries, you know, what do they tell you about this story? Like when we were in Egypt, she would ask people, tell us about the Moses story. And the one I remember the most is when we were living in the Bahamas. We were living right next to a British family, and she was so intrigued. She said, what do they tell you about the American Revolution in England? And they said, well, first of all, we don't really call it the American Revolution, and we really don't talk about it that much. It's like, you know, for half a blip, for 5 minutes on one day, in one grade, in one classroom, we might say. And then there was this thing with America, and then after that, they just go on, and they never say anything else about it.
A little skirmish.
Exactly right. A very small skirmish amidst a very long and illustrious history that England has. And it sort of speaks to, I guess, a little bit of American egotism as much as
Well, Kyle Ward, the excerpts of English textbooks that you had in the book were, I thought, treated fairly with the American Revolution.
Yeah, the one thing that's always interesting about the British text when he's talking about the American Revolution and the War of 1812 is when they do spend time and they do talk about it, outside of getting, again, the little Thomas Paine jabs and stuff like that, usually the comment is, from a military standpoint, well, we kind of screwed that up. That was our own fault. We lost those colonies, or we lost the War of 1812 because we weren't 110% behind it. So it's kind of a forgiveness in history at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. Also, they see, going a little further than Earl's question, but to the War of 1812, they see that not as a war with America, but as an incident in a long war with France.
Yeah, definitely. This is a global conflict that they were in, and their argument is that they weren't even focused in on fighting in the United States until everything was wrapped up in 1814 at Waterloo. At that point in time, then they could send their troops over, but it was, in their opinion, too little too late.
Okay. The interesting thing to build on that is quickly the Canadian version of the Revolutionary War, which calls it at one point a civil war between the loyalists loyal to the crown and those who were against it.
That is Dana Lindemann. We're also speaking with Kyle Ward. And Earl, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Let's go now to William. William's in Wilson, North Carolina.
Hi, good afternoon. How are you, gentlemen?
Okay. Great,
thanks.
Hey,
quick question. I'll take the answer off the air. Which U.S. leader or president stands out in your different versions and your study of different versions and different texts? Which leader or president stands out as the best or most admirable in your readings?
All right, Kyle Ward, or maybe just most often mentioned.
Well, I'm trying to think here. No one's jumping to mind right away here. You see a lot more of the names pop up. Kennedy was a very popular name throughout the Cold War period. But I don't really know if there's any one person, unless Dana can think of somebody, that they was held up or anything.
No, I agree with that. I think a lot of people mention Washington because the American Revolution was important, not just because it was a revolution, but because it was this, you know, the first document, the Constitution, this sort of thing. And Washington gets mentioned because he played a pivotal role. But Kennedy is probably the one that gets mentioned the most, and mostly because most countries are going to talk about the Cold War. It was a really important time during the 20th century, and Kennedy just had a really big role. In fact, the Bay of Pigs is seen as the moment, or the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis is the moment during the Cold War when both sides sort of realized that, wow, we could just totally mutually destroy each other many times over. Let's pull back from this.
Okay, William, thank you. Here's an email from George Davis in Blacksburg, Virginia. I wonder if your guest book gives any attention to comparative history within the United States, teaching at the college level in Virginia. I know that many of my students learned a different history of the Civil War than I did. I also know that Texas emphasizes, more than any other state, its own unique role in American history.
That's going to be another book on our list of things to get done here. No, most everything we looked at was always from a foreign perspective. Whenever the United States had relations with another country, we wanted to look at how these other countries dealt with it. And he's exactly right. I told somebody earlier here that in 50, 60, 70 years ago, textbook publishers in the U.S. used to market specific textbooks to specific states. They knew they had to keep certain things out in order to get more sales.
You had some comments, though, about American textbooks by comparison with their foreign counterparts. And Dana Lindemann, one of the conclusions you come to is American history textbooks are rather bland.
Definitely. I mean, yes and no. The other countries have, you know, it's the government that certain governments produce the curriculum and publish the textbooks, and they're full of ideology, which means they're full of colorful language, which means they acknowledge their bias. You know, we come from this point of view, this is your history. American textbooks are trying not to offend anybody, and many things have been written about American textbooks, which is why we didn't include any American textbook excerpts in our selections. Mm-hmm. But it's best understood having either studied in the United States or with an American textbook next to you, because you see the American version, which is the official version taught in the U.S., and then you have some of the other perspectives. But the Americans, our textbook selection, there's no national standards, for one thing. We're the exception in the world. Certain states have national or standards. I think it's 21 states have these standards. And textbook publishers publish toward those standards, but it's the market that determines it. So they published so as not to offend anybody, because if you offend a certain group, say Hispanics or African Americans or Japanese Americans, or somebody who thinks that there should be more founding fathers mentioned, if you don't have enough of that, they're going to protest. And if they protest loudly enough, your book won't be adopted.
And Kyle Ward, isn't it true that the big market states, New York, California, Texas, those are the ones who tend to buy the books and with few exceptions, other states tend to fall in line?
Yeah, those are the big market states. And what happens in these states, your Californias, Texas, North Carolinas, is that as an entire state, they adopt one history textbook for every single school. And the interesting thing to build on what Dana was saying is that we're very careful what we say. We kind of make it very bland. But what's interesting, especially compared to every other textbook that we've seen throughout the world, American textbooks have become huge. They easily top 1,000 pages. They're built like an encyclopedia with all these graphics and little interesting stories, whereas compared to most other countries around the world, you get at least half, if not smaller, portions for their textbooks.
Let's get another caller on the line. Aaron is with us from Tempe, Arizona.
Yes, interesting topic, Neil. I actually wrote my master's thesis on comparing Japanese junior high school textbooks with American high school textbooks, and specifically the Pacific War. And 2 points is that the American textbooks emphasize Pearl Harbor, of course, and the fact that it was a sneak attack, whereas the Japanese emphasize the importance of expanding their borders because of the economic depression of the time. And then also China and Japan have unable...
Just on that point, if you'll let me interrupt.
Sure.
This email we got from Ranzo Taylor. Amazingly, in 1991, my high school had a Japanese exchange student. One day in class, we discussed Pearl Harbor. He cried in shame in front of everyone. He hadn't learned this in school in Japan.
Oh, yes. It's rarely ever discussed. Now, they, of course, talk about the Pacific War at the 8th and 9th grade level and then go into more detail in the junior and the high school level. But it was something that they want to emphasize, of course, the atomic bombings and the ushering in of the nuclear age because of that, and the numbers. There's always a numbers discrepancy in terms of who died and who lived after the atomic bombings. And then, of course, the language issue is also very important. The Chinese are always upset with Japanese textbooks because they use the word advance into Mongolia as opposed to invade Mongolia.
Mm-hmm.
And that one word has... prevented them from normalizing, prevented them from normalizing relations up until 1979. And there's constantly issues brought up on the diplomatic levels of how the Japanese are going to change their textbooks to reflect what the Chinese consider the true nature of the Pacific War.
Kyle Ward, there is a chapter in your book about Japan and the Second World War.
To go on what Aaron just said, kind of the exact same thing that we found. The biggest issue usually shows up being the atomic bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and the simple fact that most Japanese textbooks usually state that the biggest reason, or maybe even the only reason, the United States used the atomic bomb was to get a message to the Russians that the Cold War is on, you better listen to us. They see it as a very brutal attack, that's something that did not have to be done. In modern day, you can think back to the Smithsonian exhibit, how this becomes still a hot topic.
Here's the paragraph from the Japanese textbook in history lesson lessons, how textbooks from around the world portray U.S. history. Was the atomic bomb really necessary in order to make Japan surrender? President Truman said that use of the atomic bomb saved the lives of tens of millions of American and Allied troops. An English scientist claimed that the dropping of the atomic bomb represented a cold-blooded sacrifice of the citizens of Hiroshima and Nagasaki as pawns in a post-war strategy towards the Soviet Union. Another theory holds that the bomb was dropped in order to justify to American taxpayers the $2 billion spent in making the bomb.
I have found that the Japanese wish to remember the Pacific War from 1945 or August of 1945 on, whereas the Americans wish to forget this, the Pacific War at that point and the aftermath that occurred as a result of the atomic bombings.
Aaron, thanks very much for the call. What did you get on the master's thesis, by the way?
I got an A. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Bye-bye. Let's call Mike. Mike is with us from Ithaca, New York.
Hi there. Yeah, when I was in England in 1975, shortly after Saddam took over in Iraq, I had a housemate from Iraq, and he told me that when they studied American history, Abraham Lincoln was portrayed not only as a great president, statesman, and emancipator, and moral role model, but also as an Arab American, which I understand people here claim as well. But most interestingly of all, that he was a great mathematician and made many contributions to algebra and set theory. And the reason why that's played down here is simply because it's very hard to be remembered as being great at two things. If you're great at two things, you usually get remembered for the thing you're more famous for, and the rest tends to get forgotten. But they do remember his algebra and look at it in Iraq. And I just want to say one other thing. I have a friend who was on the Manhattan Project, and he told me that the Japanese were suing for peace after the Hiroshima bomb, and Truman said, we better hurry up and drop the one on Nagasaki while we still can to see what a plutonium bomb will do to people. So there was that sort of research curiosity aspect as part of the motive as well, according to this witness.
According to that witness, whose documentation I think many historians would be interested to see.
Without his permission, I don't think I should give his name on
okay.
here, but he was in the Manhattan Project.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks for the call, Mike. This is an eternal question, as you point out. It rages to this day. And interestingly, you have views not only from Japan about the atomic bomb incident, the dropping of the atomic bomb, the two of them, but from Italy and as well.
Yeah, Italy is critical of the dropping of the bomb. In fact, quite a few countries are. Most of them ask, was it really necessary? And most of them come to the conclusion that, well, maybe not. There may have been some reasons for doing it, but was it really justified? Not for so many lives, probably. But it is, again, one of those topics, just like the Cuban Missile Crisis, where everybody says this ushered it in. Cuban Missile Crisis reached its peak, and in the 80s, followed the Berlin Wall was the end of it.
Kyle Ward, was there one thing that surprised you as you researched this book and read all these foreign textbooks?
The one thing that I think Dana might agree with me with on this also is that when you went through, you started reading some of the stuff from some of the old Cold War remnants, the old socialist nations of North Korea and Cuba, and some of their extreme views on this, and you kind of were expecting some of that and some of the little nitpicky things that some of the other countries had. But the one that really jumped out at me was our neighbors to the north, the Canadian textbooks, seem to have a much different viewpoint of a lot of things.
We're speaking with the authors of History Lessons, How Textbooks from Around the World Portray U.S. History. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's talk with Linda. Linda's with us from Chico, California.
Hello.
Hi.
The point is that it's not only how the textbooks cover issues, but how they're actually taught. When I grew up in New York State and I graduated in 1984, we had a student from Belfast who was there for a year, and he outscored the rest of us who had taken the American Revolution and American history. It seemed endlessly throughout our years in K through 11, and he surpassed us brilliantly. And to me, it just pointed out that it's the emphasis on history as well. We here in the United States tend to forget there's the rest of the country. Now I teach Spanish here in California, and it also seems that I'm usually the first one to teach them anything about Cuba or the Spanish Civil War or even the Mexican Revolution in Santa Ana. They say, who, what? It seems that we cover the same things over and over again. It's not just how we portray it, but how we actually teach it in the classroom.
Kyle Ward, another criticism you make of American textbooks is they are insular.
They certainly are. And then another point, following along another caller, is when my husband and I were in the Peace Corps in Grenada, we went there about 9 years after, quote-unquote, the intervention or invasion. And depending on which side you were on is what you call it. But now the day that the U.S. intervened in Grenada is actually their Thanksgiving. They're very grateful for the help we gave them, whereas we went in, we were reluctant, not knowing how they would perceive us as people from the United States.
I'd like to say here, too, real quick, that about the insularity of American history textbooks, the best example that we can give for that is we've had the opportunity to just go to the index of textbooks from around the world and the U.S., and two examples that jump to mind from you real quickly are the Philippines and Canada. You go to the back of a Philippine textbook or a Canadian textbook, and you look up the United States of America, and there are chapters sometimes. In the Philippine textbook we looked at, there was chapters 30, 31, 32, just dealing with U.S.-Philippine relations. Then you turn around and look at an American history textbook and go to their index, and the Philippines, if they're lucky, are mentioned twice, usually right around World War II
and Bataan,
Spanish-American War. And then Canada usually gets three or four, maybe even five mentions.
Linda, thank you. Let's talk now with Ron. Ron's calling from Hillsboro, Oregon.
Yeah, hello. Hello, gentlemen. My question is with respect to any social, comparative education sort of thought or ideal or objective that you may have had in mind when you wrote this book, as opposed to it being simply a kind of a fun study of different of the ways in which different cultures look at history. Is there any either implicit or explicit statement about the need for more comparative historical education in this country, and could you comment on that?
Kyle Ward?
That was kind of one of the overriding goals of this thing, since the birth of it, the idea of it came from teaching high school history students, is the fact that what we discovered is this is going to allow, we hope, more dialogue to happen in classes. It's no longer just going to be a straight lecture and telling students what happens. Now we can have more dialogue, more debate, more discussion about what other countries have to say. What does it say about these other countries then? What does it say about the U.S. since they disagree with us? I think infusing in a comparative educational concept into the classroom and in just society's dialogue as a whole are both very good things.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Ron. Interestingly, just a few seconds left in this segment, but Dana Lindemann, one of the interesting differences also was that the way history is presented, a lot of countries present a narrative as we're accustomed to in this country, but some don't.
Correct. One of the things that you're asking about, what did we learn about going through this whole thing? Just looking at history textbooks from other countries, many of them, like the French, it's just bullet points about, they give you a summary of the history, and then the facing page is primary source documents. And it leaves it open to the professors or the teachers to give an oral sort of narrative, and then to let the students discuss the history looking at the primary source documents, the evidence, the historical evidence that sits in front of them.
Hmm. We're talking with the authors of History Lessons, how textbooks from around the world portray U.S. history. When we come back from our break, we're going to continue with a couple more questions and emails. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. The email address, totn@npr.org. We'll also hear how a South Korean gymnast lost the gold medal in Athens, how he may get it back, and your letters. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we are talking with Dana Lindemann and Kyle Ward, co-authors of a new book about how textbooks around the world portray U.S. history. It's called History Lessons. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is totn@npr.org. And Joanna's with us from Vallejo, California.
Correct.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. My husband's from a small country in Central America called Guatemala that a lot of people have, like many small countries, a lot of people have never heard of. And yet our country has influenced their country tremendously in the past 100 years or so. And so we are mentioned tremendously in their textbooks, and positively or negatively, based on our behavior. But we know nothing about Guatemala or what our actions in Guatemala were, because it's not even covered in our textbooks unless maybe at the college level, for some special course on Latin American history and relationships. But, we're all over in their high school textbooks.
Kyle Ward?
That's how they know about us, from their textbooks and from their experience of us in their country.
Kyle Ward, you're the history professor.
Yeah, that goes back to what I was saying just a few minutes ago about looking back at the index. The rest of the world seems to know everything about us, and we seem to be a little bit naive sometimes about the rest of the world. Then we get involved in international affairs sometimes. I think we're shocked at the way the rest of the world reacts to us in those situations.
Could you do worse than to find out about a country by going ahead and reading its history textbook?
Could you do worse?
I mean, is that a good thing to do? I mean, as opposed to, you know, spending the time on a travel guide?
No, certainly. I think that because when you read a history textbook, you're looking at a national narrative written by national authors for a national audience. In language acquisition, we call this authentic texts. It's as if you're going next door to your neighbors and listening to the bedtime stories they tell their children or something. You're getting a real idea of who they think they are versus who the public persona that they put up to you, you know, on the street or in government relations.
Joanna, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's see if we could get one more call in. And this is Kevin, who's with us from Gladstone, Michigan.
Hi, thank you. I'm an avid history reader. And my question is, with the Truman-Eisenhower era, how does Russia view our history compared to theirs as to that era, Cold War and all?
Well, I don't know which one wants to go into this, Kyle or Dana?
I'll start off with this one. The interesting thing is, depending on, everybody has to understand that history textbooks are written today. So the politics and what's going on in society today has a bigger influence on what's in our textbook than anything else. Had we written this book 10, 15, 20 years ago during the heart of the Cold War, would have been a much different. Today, Russia's changed quite a bit. We didn't find necessarily as many differences as we probably would have during the Cold War era. But there were still some times when they have looked at the history of that period from a different vantage point.
Go ahead, Dana.
Sorry, yeah, definitely Russia is one of them that surprised us in its sort of benign coverage of certain things during the Cold War. But certain things still rest, like remain. Like you look at World War II and the D-Day, for example. The Russians look at that as it was just considered the opening of the Second Front. It wasn't this, ooh, big hoorah, here comes the West. It was, we were already suffering, we were already taking the heaviest toll, and we'd already turned the tide, and then you guys come in. A little bit late, but, you know, we took the heaviest hit.
Well, thank you very much for your comment.
Kevin, thanks for the phone call. And I'd like to thank both of my guests today for being with us. Dana Lindemann, now a professor of French at Harvard University. He was with us from our bureau in Chicago. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Neil.
And Kyle Ward, a professor of history at Vincennes University. He was with us by phone from his office in Vincennes, Indiana. Nice to speak with you as well.
Thank you very much.
Their book is History Lessons, How Textbooks from Around the World Portray U.S. History.